My slides are tweeting not as much as they did yesterday. Just a couple of little things. I also don't like to stay tethered to the front of the room, but I've discovered I can go about as far back as here, so I apologize to the people in the back and still be able to control my slides. And if I'm in your way and you can't see something, tell me that, and I'll get out of your way. There's only one thing you really need to write down on paper, and that's this link here. It's j.mp. I think of that as junk. You know, all good Web 2.0 stuff doesn't have vowels. So j.mp slash DK, that's me, VLC10. And the VLC is capitalized, the capitalization matters. So with that, those of you that are online, you can go to the wiki there and click on the link for this talk, which is called What Can I Do Now? I'm going to talk about Web 2.0 pedagogy. I'm going to talk about some of the ideas a little bit that I talked about yesterday, for those of you that were in yesterday's session, that kind of grounds the work that I do with kids. And I showed you a couple of concrete examples yesterday, but today is all concrete examples. What I'd like you to do, if you have a cell phone that can take pictures, I'd love for you to take a picture while we're in session and send it off to this address, off01soft@photo.flickr.com, if you've got them, okay? And I'm going to show you what happens to the pictures at the end. And those of you that were in my session yesterday are already hip to my jive, you know what's going to happen. But for the rest of you, yeah, it would just be really cool. And if you're, now the pictures you take will end up on the internet. So you take a picture of someone, make sure it's okay with them. It's certainly okay with me if you take a picture of me, I don't mind. Okay? Now that email address is also available on the website, where the link is for this presentation, so the jump/DKVLC10. If you click on the link for this talk, you'll see the email address right there on the page. All the slides are embedded there. All the links that I'm going to click off on the slides are also active on the website, so you don't even need to save any links. They're all there. There's a back channel for today that if you want to engage in conversation, so if you kind of just, you're not comfortable zipping around to lots of different places, that's okay. Everything that my slides view are automatically going to get pulled into this back channel. It's unfortunate the way the screen is described. But if you go to the website and click on the link for this session, there's a link that says live chat, and that's where it is. That's just where it's going to take you. And if you're on Twitter, the hashtag for this session is WP, Web Pedagogy, VLC10. Okay? Hashtag for this session if you're on Twitter. Anyone who tweets with that hashtag, that also is going to get pulled into the conversation. If you're in the chat room, you won't miss any of that. Okay? With that introductory stuff out of the way, I'm going to start with this. It's a little video I want you to watch. And what we're trying to do in this session is come up with a way to answer the question, how do you know what they know? How can you find out what's going on behind your kids' eyes in the classroom? And how can you actually come around to figure out, have they learned everything they were supposed to? How do I see that kind of stuff? How do I see evidence of that in a very concrete, meaningful way that leverages technology to serve pedagogy? Okay? So start, watch this video. And I'll ask a question for you at the end. Okay? Thank you. to tell you something about myself. My background is in senior high school. I was the department head of mathematics in grade 9 to 12 high school called Daniel Mack in Winnipeg, Manitoba. The 1,200 students in inner city school, one-third of them speak English as an additional language. We say additional language in Manitoba because some of our students arrive in our classes and English is the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh language that they're learning. And when I watch that, now understand, I come from a background of mathematics in senior high school. I watch that and I find that video makes me very upset. Why do you think that might be? Like, I think if I was where you are right now, I'd be angry. Why?
Content-based
learning?
Assessment of
results. Right, or assessment of results, okay.
Assessment through one modality.
Assessment through one modality.
They can't really showcase if that's not the modality of choice.
They can't showcase what they really know if there's only one modality to show it.
Yeah? When do they really get the opportunity to explain themselves? I mean, I'm a math teacher too,
right.
And I feel that it's very important that they explain it, and I think I know more about their learning when they can use it.
Okay,
and
so
most of the Winnipeg tests don't.
Okay, so for those of you in the back, what she's saying is that she feels it's very, she's a math teacher, and she feels it's very important for students to explain what they're doing, and you weren't seeing evidence of students explaining or demonstrating that they know what they know.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Yeah?
I get angry when I think about the amount of time that is dedicated to a pencil and paper test when we could be doing other things to students that would be more valuable to them and to us.
Okay, so very upset about the amount of time devoted to pencil and paper tests when you think about all the other things that we could be doing with students. Okay, sir?
The fact that the knowledge that's being processed by tests is not being applied to real world situations.
The knowledge tested on pencil and paper tests isn't being applied to real world situations. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am. Sorry.
Hi, sir. What gets me angry is we've been talking about this for a really long time, and we know paper and pencil tests don't work, and yet we still use paper and pencil tests, and colleges still expect children to get in based on their paper and pencil tests. So,
So she's upset because the amount of time that we devote to pencil and paper tests, people still expect those tests, the colleges expect those tests, and we really could be doing other things with the kids. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. In the video, it's the beginning started on pencil and paper tests.
Yes.
And then you went on to swimming.
Swimming.
Singing.
Singing.
Orchestra.
Orchestra.
Things that cannot be measured.
Things
on paper,
that can't be measured.
Pencil tests.
Okay.
That so many children have that we don't even tap into.
So what she saw in the video is it starts off with a discussion about pencil and paper tests and then moves on to demonstrating swimming. There's a young lady or young man on a ropes course. There's a fellow on his skateboard doing tricks. There's the orchestra, kids in the choir singing. And those things demonstrate competence and ability where a pencil and paper test can't really measure that. And there were two. There's one there and then up here. Yes, ma'am.
It makes me angry that students make decisions about their intelligence, their innate ability to learn, their love for subjects on their performance, assessments that don't even work within the context of what they're
supposed to do. Oh, you've so been a hot spot with me. A lot of kids think that the marks they get on tests is actually a measurement of their intelligence. And marks on tests have zero correlation with intelligence. You want to know how smart someone is? Have a conversation. Then you'll know how smart they are. The test doesn't reveal their intelligence per se. Sir?
Well, I had two things. One is that all of the alternatives were like visceral, physically engaged activities
mm-hmm.
that were not simply mental. And I mean, in terms of anger, it actually sort of made me remember how frustrated I was as a student.
Okay. Were you able to hear him? He said the other examples that we saw were really visceral, concrete examples of kids doing things where they really showed off how they know it, how we know, obviously, from looking, the kid on the skateboard was a still image the girl died in. It's a still image, right? The kid on the ropes course was a still image, but they obviously know what they know. Here's what really gets me about that video. Remember when I started the school that I teach, and it was an assembly. At the assembly, the choir sang, and chills ran up and down my spine. I mean, they were like angels. It was beautiful. There's no question in my mind that those kids in that choir knew what they knew, and our choir is designed. I bet yours is too. I come from an academic background. Right? What I teach is mathematics. I teach the bad formula and logarithms. Okay? And it seems to me that in schools, we do a real, real good job for providing stages for kids to show off to everybody in the world that they know what they know for our sports teams, for the performing arts, for the choir, for the band. What about my kids? What about my kids? Where are the academic stages for our children, my kids in my class, who maybe, you know, music maybe isn't their thing. Maybe listening to it, but not playing it. Maybe drama's not their thing. Maybe they don't have a job. But they really dig math. They see the beauty and transcendence in the patterns that are revealed in the study of mathematics. Where's the stage for that kid to show off, to show everybody what they know, and to get feedback on it the same way that we have a pep rally before we send off our sports team? Where's the pep rally for my class? So that's one of the things that got me upset. I also think we do a lot more than paper and pencil tests. And that's kind of a strong implication in the video. I think we do more than that. What I'd like to talk about in this session is how do we provide those stages, academic stages, for kids in English, in social studies, in math, in science, and all the subjects that typically don't have a stage for kids to show off what they've learned in concrete, meaningful ways. Now, I talked about this book yesterday. How many of you were here yesterday? Or with me yesterday? Okay. How many of you have seen this book, How People Learn? This, like, revolutionized my thinking. It's a free ebook. You can get it online from the National Academies Press. And when you find that slide, if you click on that picture, it will take you to the website where you can read the book for free online. Okay? Now what they did is very interesting. They studied, it was a meta-study. They collected a whole bunch of studies about learning. And they analyzed the studies on learning and tried to distill from that, what do we know about how people learn? And they came up with three fundamental principles of how people learn. And that was published in 1999, it was updated in 2000. In 2005, as an outgrowth of that book, they produced another book called How Students Learn History, Mathematics, and Science, specifically looking at those content areas. But whatever they were doing, they came up with three fundamental principles about how people learn. I want to talk about those principles a little more depth than I did yesterday. You know, when kids come to school, little kids, and we start to teach them about the world that they live in, one of the things we teach them is the world is round. Right, that it's a ball. Now, I don't know about you, but it doesn't look round to me. Right? Like, when I'm walking around, it looks flat. Now, understand, I'm coming from Manitoba and the prairies. It's really flat. Little kids, they come to school, the world looks flat to them, too. They walk into school, and the teacher's school is round. It's a ball. And so what they did, they analyzed kids, what kind of misconceptions the kids bring to school. When the kids left class, well, what did you learn? Well, we learned that the world was round. Really, so what does it look like? Their mental image of the world was that it was a giant pancake. If you're teaching science to young children, is this an important thing for you to know? Yeah, it is. Because the preconceptions that kids bring with them into the classroom, that's the key. That's where we begin. You don't begin with the content we have to teach. We have to begin by first exploring what are the misconceptions or preconceptions. They're not tabula rasa. They've got experience. So based on their own experience, how do they see the world, given what you have to teach them? figure out what those misconceptions are, and they may be different for every kid. This example, again, I told you, I come from a math background. When kids get the fractions, they have a hard time. Now, oftentimes kids are taught that multiplication, in early grades, they're taught that multiplication is repeated addition. Multiplication is not repeated addition. That's a good place to start. But you can't stay there. The misconception that they come out of that with is, when I multiply numbers, whatever I end up with has to be bigger than anything I started off with. Right? Whatever the two numbers I start off with, my answer's got to be bigger than both of those. So they see fractions, and it scares them, so they tune out. They see a 2 and a 3, they say a half times 3 is 6. Is this true? Is this the misconception your kids have? I don't know. You've got to talk to them and find out. But maybe. But that's the first step we have to do. Principle number one from the book. Connect with the kids' preconceptions to try to move them forward in what you're teaching. Second, learning is networked. Information we tend to think of as organized in a hierarchy, right? It's kind of like a big idea, and then you structure subcontent underneath that. In fact, that's not how knowledge is really structured.
Well, thank you.
Now I'll give you an example. Take a very simple idea, the number 3/4. When I say to you 3/4, what does 3/4 mean? Well, it could mean any of these things. It could mean 75 cents. It could mean 75%. It could mean the ratio, 3 to 4. Maybe it means 0.75, or maybe it's 3/4. I don't like when kids write fractions like that, but maybe that's just another way of writing the fraction 3/4. So when I say 3/4, which one of these was I talking about? And it gets worse, right? Because what I might have meant was 3/4. Those are Canadian coins, by the way. I might have meant the actual coins, right? 3/4, is that what I meant? Or maybe I was thinking 3/4 of a cake. Now, when I say 3/4 of a cake, there's another idea buried inside of that one. 3/4 of the cake, each of the quarters is the same size. Each piece is the same size as every other. That's kind of buried into that. We don't say that explicitly. And then, when I talk about the ratio of 3 to 4, so for example, I've got, you guys don't have smart ideas. I mean, you're going to tell me you do, but they're pressed powdered candy right now. Well, that's rockets. Okay, what can I tell you? Right? They're flat M&Ms. We call them Smarties. So anyway, so if you took red to blue Smarties or flat M&Ms, okay, and you make the ratio of 3 to 4, well, when I make the ratio of 3 red to 4 blue Smarties, they don't all have to be the same size for my ratio of 3 red to 4 blue to still be true. And that's part of that too. And then lastly, I might say 75% off. When I was talking about the cake, I was talking about 3/4 of the cake that was there. When I say 75% off, I'm talking about 3/4 that aren't there. So what do I mean with like the idea, a simple idea, 3/4 lives in actually this network of connections concept. And it's our job as educators to make those connections clear and explicit, to uncover the linkages between all the different contexts in which we understand 3/4. As experienced learners, you all understand what I meant from the context around what I was saying when I say 3/4. But if we go too abstract, then what am I talking about? Knowledge is actually networked. And it's not just networked in the sense of concept. You've got to structure the learning around the big ideas of the discipline that you're teaching, whatever it is, and understand how all the other ideas live around in a network. But there's more than that. Think of your own learning as professionals. Do you remember your student teaching? I know when I spoke to student teachers, right, and talked to them right after they had their first teaching experience, and they're wrecked. Right? And I say to them, okay, so there's good news and there's bad news. There's only one thing worse than student teaching. Your first year. Right? Because you got your own class or classes, you're going to take them through a whole year, you're going to teach a bunch of courses you've never taught before, and you're going to have to gather resources and figure out all this stuff. And then for experienced teachers, we still get an echo of that feeling every time they assign a new course to us to teach that we've never taught before. Now put yourself in that mind frame. What do you do? when you get assigned a new course you've never taught before, or your student teaching, or your first year teaching, you've never taught any of that stuff before, what did you do?
Network with colleagues.
Right? You read, do some research, you start pulling things in, but you find the person who's taught that course before, and you say, so what did you do? What did you do? Can you share that with me? Like, teaching this idea is tough, but knowing a thing and doing a thing is not the same thing. Right? Did you, you know, well, I'll talk about that a little bit later. But anyways, knowing a thing and doing a thing are different things. And so what we do is we start branching out and networking with other people. So the second principle that knowledge is network, it's not just structured around big ideas and discipline. It actually lives in the nodes in your social network, your professional network. When you reach out to colleagues in the classroom next door, down the hall, or if you're involved in some online social network or professional learning environment, then you can connect there. Because social knowledge isn't in our heads, it lives between us. It's when we share. The best part of this is going to be when I'm done talking and you go for coffee. And it's not going to be the coffee. Right? It's going to be the conversations that you have. Because real learning is a conversation. You're not talking to somebody about it, you're not learning. Okay. Third principle out of the book, and we're going to go to concrete examples. Learning is facilitated through the use of metacognitive strategies. What they found in the book was that if you can get kids to think about what they're learning as they're learning it, that will deepen their own understanding of the content that they're busy trying to get their heads around. And in particular, what they found was that when you have people who are low-functioning, or the high-functioning learners, the kids that generally do well, when you engage them in these kind of metacognitive strategies, they see some gains in their learning, but only moderate gains. But for the low-functioning learners, if you engage them, thinking about what they're learning as they're learning them, the gains for those kids were huge. So that's the third principle out of the book, and let me show you an example. So how do you, you know, concretely, so what do? Nice of you to say, be metacognitive, huh? Now, okay, so one idea I have is error analysis. Did you catch it?
Yeah.
Okay. Error analysis. Can you find the error in the thing that you're looking at? In math, you give them the solution and say, is it right? Is there an error there somewhere? There is an error. Can you find it? What's the error? Can you articulate that? Here's another one. Look at the picture. There's an error there somewhere. Now think about what's going on in your own head. As you look at the picture and you're thinking about what is the error? What's the same? What's the same as everything else? What's different? What could he possibly be talking about when he says there's an error, find the error in the picture? And all I've done is put a picture of three Mounties. Remember, I'm Canadian. Three Mounties up on the board and said, find the error. What's going on in your head right now? Think about your own thinking right now as you look at that image and try to find the error. Your level of engagement maybe went up a little bit. Level of attention maybe went up a little bit. That's one possible metacognitive strategy. These three ideas form what I call a pedagogical framework. So whatever's happening in your classroom, these are the ideas that sit invisibly around concrete things that you do with your kids to deepen their own learning. Because this is how people learn, right? Connect, number one, connect with their preconceptions. That's where you got to start before you start teaching them something new. Number two, learning is networked. Not only do you structure learning around the concept, the big ideas of the discipline, but there also has to be a social network around it, an opportunity for kids to engage in dialogue and wrestle with the material. And lastly, we need to find ways to engage kids and metacognitive strategies around what's happening in the classroom to think about what they're learning as they're learning it. And these three together pack a powerful punch. There's actually a fourth, but I'll talk about that tomorrow. Three instructional practices. Three instructional design practices. So those come out of the book. This is kind of like my own thinking. And what I found about trying to bring these things down into my classroom and applying it to the various uses of Web 2.0 tools. What are the affordances? What are the new possibilities? What can I do now that I couldn't do before, given all these tools that I have available to me? So let me take you through those quick. The first is, principle number one is create galleries of thought. Every time kids do any kind of work, I want to find something right now, as I look over the room. and I look at your eyes, and I've got no idea what's going on behind your eyes. And some of you have smiled at me when I said jokes, thank you very much. But oftentimes, especially in my class, I've got no idea what's going on behind their eyes. And oftentimes what I do as the expert in the room is I'm trying to reveal to my students the way I've structured the information, the way I pull it all together, and I want them to see that. I want to find ways to make my thought transparent to them. Problem is, I have a little more expertise than they do, and I suffer from the curse of knowledge. It seems easy to me. It's not easy to them. They've never done it before. And the things that they're struggling with, I may have forgotten. So how do I want to make my thinking transparent to them, but I also need to make their novice thinking transparent to each other. Because novices not only need to see how experts think, they also need to see how other novices think. Because they need to see the errors that they make and the good work that they do, because they may conceptualize it in a totally different way. How many of you have ever had a kid produce some work and say, like, how did you get that? And it's right, but like, what did you do? Right? Because they think about it differently. Those ideas, the process, needs to be made visible to the kids, to all the novice learners, but they also need to see how the expert knows. And me as expert, I need to get some insight into what's going on behind your eyes, behind my students' eyes. So I want to create galleries of thought, and that's what I want to use those web tools for. I'm going to create galleries of thought. Second, publish it. Whatever the kids are doing, and these things, I had the extra drawing, it's kind of instructional, right? Okay, the reason I have that extra drawing there is because these three principles, like you can't separate a breeze from the wind. And you can't separate a current from the stream. You can talk about them separately, but in fact, they're kind of linked up together. So these three instructional design principles, we can talk about them separately, but you can't really tease them all apart. They overlap. Okay? So the second one is publish it. Take the kids' work and publish it. Find some way to put it online so that it generates not just that gallery of thought, but you need to find a way to create an authentic audience for the work you're doing. Remember I was talking about creating academic stages. I want to create that stage where my kids' awesome academic work is being demonstrated for the world to see, where other people can find it, possibly interact with them, if I can orchestrate that somehow. Not an easy thing to do. Now, why publish student work? Because there's a lot of concern. If you start putting student work online, there's issues of copyright, there's issues of safety, et cetera, et cetera. And those concerns are genuine. But let me start with a story. I want to show you a grade 5 class. This is a grade 5 class in New York. And their teacher, they have a blog. And the teacher just, every time they learn a new song, the teacher's got like a digital camera, and he records them, right? And then he publishes on the class blog. I want you to watch the video, and there's a bit more of a backstory to this, which I'll tell you about afterwards. Oh, and watch their bodies, watch how they move, particularly the little girl in the front. The best part is the very, very end.
Yeah.
favorite part right there. When the teacher, at the very end, turns around and looks in the camera and says, with all the passion in the world, "That was good."
Good, yeah.
There was so much for me is packed into that. When the teacher says that about this kid who just finished singing, he loves them. And you know they love him back. But sometimes we didn't plan and the kids obviously love him. That little girl in the front, at one point, the lyric in the song is, right? The lyric is, "Now I built my love around you," which points out this is directly to you. Because the relationship that we have with the kids in our classes is so fundamental to the work that we do with them. When that's a good relationship, when things are going well between student and teacher in the classroom, then learning, you can go anywhere. You can do anything. When there's tension, when there's friction between teachers and students, you all know. That's when things stop. That has to be dealt with first. Because you can't do anything until you get over that. Anyways, let me tell you a little bit about this. Teacher has a blog and just habitually publishes these videos on YouTube. Has anyone seen this before? Do you know what happened with this video?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Ashton Kutcher tweets it.
Ashton Kutcher tweets it.
Yeah, it's like, really? Yeah, tons of
well, what happened was when he first put it on YouTube, Stevie Nicks, her song Landslide, Stevie Nicks is on tour. And the tour manager saw the video on YouTube and says, "Hey Stevie, you gotta see this." And he sits her down in front of the video and he says, "Watch," and Stevie watches the video twice, bawling her eyes out. Okay? So because the guy's got a blog, and now they get in touch with him, they exchange email, this goes back and forth a little while. His grade 5 class, because Stevie Nicks is on tour and they're going to be performing at Madison Square Garden, gets invited to Madison Square Garden. And what the discussion was, they're going to perform with Stevie. And that's not actually what happens. They don't perform with Stevie, but they do get invited to perform for Stevie at the sound check. And the kids all come up on stage, and they sing for Stevie. At one point, Stevie stands up, and she's conducting, you know, the kids as they're singing. We're not going to watch all of that, because that goes on for about 8 minutes. But what she does, when the kids are finished, the stage manager is like, "Get these kids out of here. We got a show, this is Madison Square Garden." Stevie says, "Don't move them anywhere." She insists the kids stay on stage. She goes up on stage and goes to each and every single kid, one by one. She gives them a hug and she says, "Hang on to your dreams. Dreams can come true." Each and every kid. The most popular comment made by all the kids, "She smells so nice." You can't play lessons like that. There's no way, like that's not what he intended when he's putting his kids' videos online. At least mom and dad, parents, family, come see it. What ends up happening is that all these actors from all over the world start now saying, "Hey, I want to sing with this choir." If you go to their blog now, they have sung with the biggest names in the music business. There was, there's this group, Celtic Women, I think it's called. Celtic Women came to sing with the band. They were interviewed after singing with the choir. It's called the choir of the band. Anyway, they came to sing with the choir, and when they were interviewed, the Celtic Women is like this big band, okay? Was that going to be good enough? To sing with the grade 5 choir. Again, you can't. So why publish kids' work? Find ways to publish the good stuff that your kids are doing, the hard work that they're doing, trying to get their heads around, learning what they have to learn from you, because that opens the door on serendipity. see on the slides, it explains everything. Find ways to get kids to create content that educates. And the reason I say that has to do with this. You're familiar with Bloom's taxonomy. It was revised in 2000. It used to have synthesized and evaluated at the top. Synthesized is gone. Evaluated is going down. We have creative at the top. And you've heard this a lot at BLC. Everybody's talking about creating content. And why create? Because when kids are working at the lower end of the of Bloom's taxonomy, remembering and trying to demonstrate understanding, or not demonstrate, but trying to understand words, that's considered generally lower order thinking skills. If you can get them working as a top, where they're creating content, when they create something, that necessarily requires that they're going to remember, understand, apply, analyze, and evaluate the stuff that they're creating as they're working with it. So that kind of pushes them to the very top in terms of the highest order thinking. And that's really where we want to spend most of our time, in terms of designing learning experiences for students. We want to think about how you're going to get them to create whatever you're teaching. And I think the triangle was drawn wrong because it emphasizes the wrong thing. I like it like this, that, right? Create from the top, flip it over. The other thing is, now I'm going to take a little pause, okay? Take my presentation to this point, put it on the shelf. I've got to tell you about this and then we'll come back.
Okay.
This is the biggest hoax in education going on. Again, I kind of feel like a duty. I once in a workshop actually used this, and ever since I feel this duty to correct that error by telling as many teachers as possible. It's a lot, okay? Maybe you've seen this, the learning pyramid. It says that we retention rates, right? We retain 5% of what we hear in a lecture, 10% of what we read, 20% that comes to us in audio, visual, 30% from a demonstration, et cetera, up to 90% when we're teaching others. Okay, that's all nonsense. But what's nonsense is the numbers. It's not the triangles, it's the number. Like, think about it for a few seconds. How are you going to separate audio and audiovisual? Like, how do you tear that apart? Also, what is it about humans that works out so nicely? 5, 10. We're not filled that way, right? We're a lot more messy. Also, the National Training Laboratory in Bethel, Maine, that's where it's always cited as the original source. It's their contact. National Training, Bethel, Maine. Oh, great. You guys did the research, yeah? So can you provide who did it? When was it done? Can we see the research? They don't answer. They're pestered. Please, you know, we really, the source, where is it? Letter, email comes back. And I have sources to all this online. You can check it all out. The email comes back. This research was, in fact, done here. But we don't know who did it. We don't have it. Okay? So, where it actually comes from is something called Dale's Cone of Experience. I'm going to go back right here. It comes from something called Edgar Dale's Cone of Experience. And what Dale talked about was levels of abstraction. And it wasn't that like lecture was less important than teaching others, because it was a cone that talked about this is more abstract and this is less abstract. And sometimes when you're teaching, you move through various levels, maybe in the same class, in the same learning experience, and we go back and forth. And that's what Edgar Dale was talking about. Okay? Nonetheless, I still think, with all that said, that this is true. Teaching is listening, and learning is speaking. You want to know what your kids know, listen to them talk. Because real learning is a conversation. And if you can orchestrate it in the class so that the kids are all talking about the stuff that they're wrestling with, and you've got an opportunity to hear that, it gives you some insight into how they think about it. What are their misconceptions? How are those conversations going? There was an interesting bit of research was done. You know the use of clickers? They're getting real hot now in schools, right? Okay, for pull everywhere is free. I'll just say that and stop. Anyway, so there's an interesting bit of research. What they did was they asked kids a question. Their choices, A, B, C, D, right? And the kids clicked in their answer, A, B, C, D, like we did yesterday after the game, right? So teacher provided no comments. They just said, now, in groups of three, talk to each other. Okay? Talk about what and what your answers were. And then they were asked again. Okay, now you can make your choice a second time. Here's the question, A, B, C, D. Click in with what you think the correct answer is. No direct instruction from the teacher at all. And the number of correct answers, second time around, went through the roof. Okay, so what if the smart kid was talking to all the other kids and now everybody knows the answer, right? So they asked another question. The same kind of content, but a different question, and no opportunity to have that dialogue, but like, did they learn, right? Did they learn the concept?
Yeah.
Yeah, so like, we, here's the question, we talked about it, we learned it, maybe I learned it from the smart kid, but did I? Or maybe I just did, the smart kid says do this, so I did that. They asked another question in the same content area, same concepts being tested. No opportunity for kids to network and dialogue. And they found that those kids on that question that did it in this style did way better on that question than kids who never had the opportunity to dialogue. Okay, so think about that when you use, it doesn't mean the teacher, it doesn't matter. Teachers matter, big time, okay? You cannot take a teacher out of education, okay? But that's one technique, one thing that you might, effective use of Twitter, of clickers. Anyways, I think that if you marry those two together, the idea of creating content and teaching others, because you don't need to tell a room full of teachers, right? Like, the stuff that you teach, until you actually had to teach it, you didn't actually know it nearly as well, right? As like doing a thing and teaching a thing is not the same thing. Teaching a thing is actually a powerfully deep learning experience. So are your kids having those powerful deep learning experiences? Like, do you build assignments, activities? Do you structure your classes around this notion so that kids have this opportunity on a regular basis to teach other people what they're learning? Because that's one of the most powerful learning experiences they can have. So what does it all look like in practice? Well, I thought of something like, well, I'm going to show you a number of examples now. Okay, a number of examples that take these ideas and concretely applies those three principles, pedagogical principles, and those three instructional design ideas, and we're going to bring them together. What does this look like when I actually start making up assignments? What do those assignments look like? So I was thinking about mind maps. I like mind maps because they get to the network stuff. But if I'm the only one that sees it, like me and the kid, that's not good enough. So I was also thinking about kids and their cell phones. And I know kids, like, they all have cell, I got the worst cell phone in the world, right? Yep, together. Okay. So, but the worst cell phone in the world today, and I actually deliberately hang on to this, the worst cell phone in the world today can do four things. You can send a text. You can talk, you can send a picture, and you can take video. They can take a picture, it can take video, right? Most, like, I think I'm talking about 90%+ of cell phones now, right? So how am I going to get them to use their cell phones in a meaningful way in the classroom? So I got them to create these digital mind maps. The assignment was, with your cell phone, as you're walking around, remember I teach math, right? And one of the things that I have to teach is this beast called the quadratic formula, right? Something that has frightened people down the ages, okay? And I've got to make it meaningful to kids. So we did a unit on quadratics, and then maybe trigonometry, and we did some algebra, and then I say, okay, now that we've done, I want you to go back to the stuff we did on quadratics. I want you to take a picture in your world. You're walking around the world. Look around you. You see in your world quadratics. And I want you, with your cell phone, I want you to find a picture online. I want you to take a picture with your cell phone and send it to your Flickr account. And the kids get a Flickr account. We do a 5-minute demo in class. One kid gets an account. Once one kid has an account, they can all do it. Okay? And then this is what one of them made. So this particular picture is the quadratic that this young lady made. Now, why Flickr? Because you can put these hotspots on it. So when I move my mouse over the picture, she says, just over here, she's explaining all the things. She's a mind map. It's kind of a brain dump on the image of a quadratic, which is this mirror. A quadratic, for those of you who don't teach math, it's a graph that looks like a U shape.
Thank you.
Right? It's either a valley or a hill. Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have said that earlier. So it's either, you know, hill shape like this or U shape like that. So when she looks at this mirror, she sees the U shape, and she starts unpacking, like, here's the vertex, those of you that teach math, HK, and she's got all the proper language and terminologies being used there. She's explaining it, and at one point, you know, she says, this is, like, just like on the other side, I've got roots, x, intercepts, and zeros. Now, over here on the right, there's these tags. Now, she's used quadratic because that tag is for the assignment. But the other tag there, PC30F, PC30SF06, why that tag? That tag doesn't mean anything to anybody in the world except me and my students. See, let me explain. The name of the course was Pre-Calculus 30Fs. And I taught it in the fall semester of 2006. See, it means something to me and my kids, but nobody else. So I don't think anyone else is using this tag anywhere.
Right.
So I created a unique tag. And when I do that, just by having that tag, this is all Sherry's content with that tag on it, but this is the whole class.
Oh, wow.
Right? Just through that one link. And any work that they do anywhere online, there it is. Like, here's another image that another student in that class did. And this is a picture of actually something that he saw in my classroom.
Sir, could you briefly show how you create a little tag, not a tag, the box?
Right, like these?
Yeah.
Okay, so at the moment, I think I'm logged into my account. So here's me. Let me go over to my account. I'll click on this picture. This is my friend. But by the way, I see no one has sent in any pictures yet. Please, send those pictures. Oh, you did? Okay. My bad. Anyway, so up here, once you're logged in on your account, at the top of the image, at the top left there, it says add note. So if I click on that box, it puts this little box here on the screen. And now, I can move it around, change its size, and say, Bud is from Colorado. And if I want, I can even put in a link. And then save it. And now, when I come here, there's the text. I'll zoom in a bit so you can see. Does that make sense? Did that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. So that was just one assignment. Okay, that assignment is like a little assignment. You take maybe last week, if that long. I like to give the kids a big chunk of time for this. Like, spend the next 2 weeks walking around the world looking for quadratics. And here's the thing. If the only thing is that she sees her work and that's it, it dies there, and I see it, that's not good enough. Galleries of thought. And I want kids to see each other's thinking. Because of that tag, and because of the magic of RSS, if you want to know about that stuff, talk to me later or talk to someone else at the conference. But because of the way those technologies work, I was able to create on their blog, PC30S406.
Can you repeat the tag?
For this class? PC30SF06. Pre-calculus 30S in the fall of 2006. So this is the class blog, and through the magic of RSS, we aggregate all the images dynamically, are aggregated on the side of the blog. So as long as the kid tags it, it's going to end up here, and then we can see anything that any kid does as it's revealed here on the blog. So they can see, because I want them to see how other novices think. I need to see it, yes, but they need to see each other's work as well. And so we end up with, here's something else that Sherry did. Okay, and she's got all her stuff there. So that's one example. If I'm going to make my kids do it, I do it too. Right? And now that, if you stand on the east, southeast door of my school, and you look across the street, that's what you see. Okay? I took that with my cell phone, with my crummy little cell phone, and I sent that off to Flickr. And if you look at that, I put the hotspots on it. Now, there's a whole lesson that I give about the... It's like really geeky math stuff, okay? But the binomial theorem, okay? And part of that is something called the Fibonacci sequence. It turns out that the Fibonacci sequence is just a series of numbers. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8. There's a pattern, okay? 1, 1, 5, 3, 2, 8, and it goes on, okay? It turns out that the Fibonacci sequence is actually encoded into our bodies. The other way around. The Fibonacci sequence has got another number encoded in it called phi. And I go through all of this, and if you read the beginning of Dan Brown's book, what was the first one? Da Vinci Code? That was my lecture. Anyway, so it turns out that trees grow like this. And if you want to draw a good tree, if you're in art, you want to draw a really good tree, draw it so if you imagine a horizontal line going through the tree, it's going to make one cut, and then two cuts, and then three cuts, and then five cuts. The next one should be eight. However, humans don't leave trees alone. We go in there like this branch here, this got trimmed. If it hadn't gotten trimmed, I would have had eight branches at that level, I only have seven now. Right? When you're walking around the road, go see. right? Look, imagine horizontal cuts in trees. If you want to draw something that looks like a tree, respect that rule, and your tree's going to look tree-like no matter how kind of, like, I'm a terrible drawer. So anyway, so this came up in lots of other places. I found geometry in the back lane, so but my dad, I'm going to skip those examples because I'm going to run out of time. But if you teach something like art, this was really interesting. An art teacher used this particular image to teach all the various artistic effects that can be brought to bear. The teacher put the hot spots on the picture, explaining linear perspective. This is what the fellow's using here. Then over on this side, we've got some shadows. And this is the art technique that's being used there in that image. Then, not only can you flicker your teaching, you can flicker their learning, because this time she puts up an image and she says, you guys go put the hot spots. Now find all the techniques that I've told you about. And if you go look on this, you see all the hot spots contributed by students with links to their names, their Flickr accounts. There's actually a whole story to this picture, because at first the kids were only putting in these long comments, and then the teacher comes in and she says, hey, how come no one is using this feature? And then she comments on what the kids have been learning so far, and then eventually the kids go and start adding comments. But it's an interesting archive of even that story. Let me give you another example. Sorry, did we have a question back there?
Yeah, just quickly, I didn't catch how it is that we can aggregate pictures on Flickr on Swamp.
Oh, Flickr,
yeah.
Right? Have these in consistent tag that picks up your stuff.
Right.
And on Flickr, there's a tool called a batch. If you search for badge on Flickr,
badge,
B-A-D-G-E,
right.
And then there's a little tool that says, well, do you want to attach it to a tag? And you say, yeah, type in the tag, and it creates that badge for you. A little chunk of, like, code, which you don't have to understand. It's copy, paste, it's on your blog. Okay? So solution manuals. Solution manuals use a lot of math and science. But the thing with solution manuals is very few people read them, sometimes only the teacher, or maybe just that one kid. And I'm trying to get kids engaged in this, so I said, well, what about instead of having them read the solution manual, what if they wrote the solution manual for the course? And I said, let's do it on a wiki. So what we did was, now, how many people know what a wiki is? Is there anybody who doesn't know what a wiki is? Right? A wiki is a website that does exactly two things, and that's it. You land on this webpage, if it's a wiki, there's nothing there, you click edit, you put some stuff, you saved and you've made an original content contribution, that's it. That's the first thing a wiki does. The second thing a wiki does, you come to a web page, you see there's stuff there, you go, oh, I could do that better, or wait, there's a spelling error, or they should put this in. So you go edit, you add that stuff, save. You modify the pre-existing content. You either make an original contribution or you modify the existing content. That's it. That's what a wiki does. That made Wikipedia. Okay? Pardon me?
And then you discuss it.
And then you discuss it. Yeah, there was a whole other, well, we can talk about the discussion tab at any time. But anyways, so I said, if that's the basic functionality of a wiki, how is that going to tumble out in the class and in the students' learning? So I want students to get 2 weeks, it's usually 2 weeks leading up to the final exam. Week one, they have to do what's called a significant contribution. Okay? They have to, I seed the wiki with a bunch of exam level problems. The kids come to the wiki, each kid gets one problem, they solve that problem, showing all steps, and then annotate that solution well enough so that an interested learner can learn from them. That's it, week one. Find one problem, solve it as best you can, explain how you did it, done. This is really an overnight assignment. I give them a week because I want it to be low pressure, and I tell them I want your very best work. So you know what they do, they go in, they find the easiest problem that they know how to do, and that's the one they do. Right? But then there's week two. Week two is the other part. It's a constructive modification. You've got to go into the wiki, and you've got to look at all the work that's been done by your classmates, find one solution that's wrong, find an error, and fix it. Think about that. Kid that chose what was the easiest problem for them, now they have to go figure out how to correct all the stuff that they didn't think was the easiest thing for them to do. And they've got to make it better. Now sometimes, and it's never happened by the way, like everyone says, well, what if it's all right? It hasn't happened yet, okay? But the other option they have is a constructive modification is make it better. Like, here's a solution that's all right, but if they didn't put a graph there, they should have. Add the graph. Or you know what? If you'd used color in a better way, in the way this was explained, if there's some explanatory elements you can bring in, then do that and make it better. So that's what the kids do. And I've got kids doing this in all kinds of classes. Every class ends up doing this, and that's the second week. The constructive modifications make the wiki better in some constructive way. So sometimes it's not exactly all math that they're doing, but they do scan through all those questions. So this one describes the assignment, and then on the side I've got the question list. The rubric that I use to grade them is here, which you're welcome to lift and use as you please. getting math expressions on the web can be hard, so here's a little widget that does it for them. It's kind of click and play. And let's look at one of the questions. So here what we've got at the top is I seeded that question up there, and as we scroll down, they've got something here called quick find code for the problem. And then there's a legend that involves color. Colors used mean different colors, mean different things. And if we look at the solution, they've got well-formatted equations there, different colors at different points. Look at the graph that they're using. We keep scrolling down. Here's, you know, these two circles are actually integral to solving this problem. It's a calculus problem for my AP calculus class. In red, they're pointing upper function to the outside, and blue inside. And this goes on and on and on and on. The question is, of course, well, who did what? So at the very top of the page, there's a link here that says page history. And when I click on the page history and I look at all the revisions, I can see who did what and when. When I scroll down to the bottom, I see over here, when I scroll down to the bottom, you can see that these were edits made by me. And then some student named Jamie comes in, and the last edit that Jamie makes is here, April 19, 2009, at 10:57 and 46 seconds. That's when she finished. Okay? So now I want to see what Jamie did. So as I scroll down and look at this version, there's no quick find code, but there is that legend. That was Jamie's idea, the different colors in different ways, well-formatted equations and all that. There's no graph. She didn't do that graph. And look at that picture of the circles. It's wrong. Not two different colors, and the arrows are pointing to the same spot. Okay? Well then, okay, so who did what? Well, let's go back and look at the history on that. I see that the next student that comes in is this student named Zeph. So I click one button next to Zeph's, the last one that Zeph did and the last one that Jamie did, and I want to compare those two. Everything in green, Zeph did. Everything in red, he deleted that she did. So now I know if his contributions are trivial or significant. Not only that, if I actually want to look at the page as it looked when Zeph was done with it, then I just kind of click on the link for his day, and hey, he's the one that put in the graph.
What tools are you using for all the graphing and the mathematical equations?
The mathematical equations is right there on the side of the wiki.
It is.
It's SITMO equation editor, S-I-T-M-O equation editor, and the kid that did that graph is using a website called FooPlot, FOOPLOT.com, and then a screen capture. So Zeph does the graph, but he didn't catch this mistake, right? So who did? Well, I see that there's one edit here made by someone named Benjamin. A single edit, and if I compare and look at the changes that he's done, then what I'm going to see is, let's see what I'm going to see. It's kind of loading slowly. It looks like I just got kicked off, eh?
We're all trying.
Is everybody off? Did everybody get kicked off the internet? I can't even get into Google.
Yeah.
Hey, long story short, what you'll see is that he makes trivial edits. He takes out double lines. Like, the separators were double lined. He didn't like that, so he took them out. That was his contribution. It's like, well, that doesn't get you anything.
Yeah.
But then when I actually go look at his edit, when I actually clicked on the link, that the one that he made, he fixed the diagram with the circles. He made it blue and red, and he put the and that is really significant to solving that particular problem. Okay? So if you're familiar with the content, you'd understand that actually is, even though he's only made one edit, that's not small potatoes. Like, he's actually done something significant there. So it looks like the internet's died, so.
You can log right back in.
Okay.
So that's a new way for you to give your assessment and how they're really graded. They really don't have to worry about like what their actual grade will be because it's all about their problem solving together.
Yeah, so the kids, there's collaboration involved, but the kids are also, like if you look at the rubric, they're assessed on each piece that they do. So it's their work that they're being assessed on, and the collaboration is built in there, and it's all authentic, right? Like, look, I teach senior math. I don't have any, my curriculum's like this. Like, those of you that were in my session yesterday, you know, my course is 110 hours, and I have about 72 hours to teach it in. Like, that's what I've got. I've got no time to fool around. Like, if this is not going to move kids forward in their learning, if this isn't going to help us get better at what we're trying to do in the room, then we're not doing it. We don't have any time for that. Okay, so all of this stuff I found to actually be valuable. Now, the other idea I had, now that I haven't tried this with students yet, I have had students create video, where they create a video and they often try to have them create commercials. By the way, my rule of thumb is a commercial should be 1, maybe 2 minutes, don't go longer than 2 minutes, for lots of reasons. One, you want them to condense what they've learned, and Lord, you don't want to watch 30 videos that are 20 minutes long each, right? Where the kids are just kind of getting very narcissistic and, you know. So,
YouTube has a 10-minute length anyway.
And YouTube has a 10-minute length, but I would say 2, right? Short, like think of it this way, okay? Do you ever get an email from someone, like they send you a YouTube video and say, oh, you gotta see this? And it generally gets you like one of those videos like an hour long, and like you go, you click, it's an hour, it's like,
yeah.
I'm not gonna watch that. But what about when they send you a link that's like, you know, a minute? Will you watch that?
Yeah.
Yeah, 2 hours later, you've watched a minute long videos for two, so you're fine watching 2 hours of video in 1 minute chunks, but 1 hour of video in a 1 hour chunk, that's not okay?
Right.
Right? Well, we're all the same. We're all the same. So structure it so that the kids, right, and a minute, maybe two. I started off by asking them to do 30 seconds. It just wasn't long enough. By the way, I said not counting credits and bloopers. Bloopers wasn't my idea, by the way. That was theirs. But they did a blooper reel. Hey, this is, if you're familiar with medicine, med school, when doctors are being trained, they're being trained as surgeons. So this is the rule of thumb that they use in med school. You're training a surgeon to do a procedure, and he's got to watch another surgeon do it again and again and again before he's allowed to try it himself. After doing that many times, the surgeon can then do the procedure himself. But they're not regarded as having learned the procedure until they teach it to someone else. Right? Watch it, do it, teach it. That's the paradigm in med school. So that's the paradigm. It leads to deep learning in the ways we've already talked about, right? Knowing the thing, teaching the thing, not the same thing. So I try to bring that down into my class for all the reasons I've already said. And in this case, what I've asked the kids to do is, well, I want to give you the inspiration. I don't know if you've ever, this is a kind of a video that I have a playlist, like a digital ethics playlist, and one of the videos, this, which you'll find on YouTube, and this particular video, we'll see if the internet's going to work. It's not looking good.
You're sure it was really good?
Now, anyways, what that little video does, see what happens if you switch browsers. Is anybody else kicked off the internet?
Yeah, but you can log right back.
Okay. It won't even bring you to the login page. Anyways, what I had them do, and again, the links are all embedded in the slides so you can see it yourself, it's kind of like, you know those books where you flip the head, like, should you do this or should you do that, right? They're kind of like 14 stories and turn to this page. Well, I did that with video, right? So here's a problem. Here's how to solve this equation. So we do this. Here's the first step. Now, what do we do next? Do we do this or do we do that? And what I'm thinking of is, what is the common error made here? That's one of the options. And what's the correct answer? Students have to make a decision. They click on one or the other. They click on whichever one they click on. Let's say they click on the wrong answer. It takes them to the next video in the sequence and says, I'm sorry, you got that wrong. Here's the mistake you made. Go back and try again. They click, it takes them to exactly the point in the video, and they need to make the choice again. They choose the correct answer. Congratulations, You got it right. So now the next thing we would do is this, and again, what's the common error? Error analysis. Give them two choices. Then they click and so on. They get to the end of the solution. Now, in this example, I made it. But that's not the assignment you give your kids. The assignment you give your kids is you make it. Here's an equation. I want you to think about how it's solved properly. I want you to fork off at different places and find what's the common error that's made. And build your, the technology takes maybe an hour, right? But the thinking involved and how am I, what's the common error? How do I want to structure it? I've had kids work on this in groups of two, maybe three, never more than three, because if you go to, three is a working group, four is a social occasion, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So.
How do you get the video to go from
to twerking again? I'll show you. You know what, that's actually, I can show you afterwards. I'm running out of time.
Okay.
And I do want to spend a minute or two. So this is the one that I made, the kind of choose your own path mathematics. Welcome to find your own path through the mathematical equation. In this example, we've got on the left 2 times x plus 3 equals x over 2 minus 1 plus 4. What is the first thing we should do to solve this equation? What's the first step? Is it, well, it's going to be getting rid of those brackets on the left-hand side. And if we do that, do we get an expression like this in blue, or do we get an expression like this, the one we've got here?
I did this in Smart Notebook.
You've got a few seconds to decide. Thank you.
And then they have to pick. Do you think it's a blue answer? Choose blue or green? Choose green. Let's say the kid chooses blue. So they click on that, and it takes them to the next video in the sequence.
Oh. So it's another
link. Right. So it's another link
to
another segment. So when I recorded it, I did it once all the way through, and then I chopped up my recording into different pieces. But I had to plan, okay, here's where I'm going to branch. These are the two possibilities. This is how I'm going to set that up. So there's a lot of thought that goes into planning how that's out, deciding what is the common error, like for a kid to think about, what's the common error that my classmates are likely to make? And let me teach them how not to do that. Like, that's powerful stuff, okay? Anyways,
you selected blue. I'm sorry, but that's not right. You didn't distribute the 2 times both terms. You did 2 times.
Hey, because it goes through and explains to them why it's wrong,
now,
what the right answer
what's
is.
What's the next step?
And then it asks
what
them what the next step is.
We want to get rid of fractions on the right so there are no fractions anywhere. Do we end up with the blue expression, this one here, or the green one, this one here? You've got a few seconds to decide.
Layering music in the background makes it easier for kids to watch. Thank you. And if they choose blue, that's the wrong answer.
You chose the blue expression. I'm sorry, that's not right. You did multiply both expressions on the right by 4, but you didn't multiply the left-hand side by 4.
Yeah,
go back and try.
I know.
And they go back and try again, and it takes them to exactly the point in the previous video.
What are we
going to make a choice?
We want to get rid of fraction.
Smart notebook. Whatever IWB you're using, but you can also just do it in a Word document, right? You know, you just like put a or a draw document, cover it up, remove it, etc.
And how did you hyperlink the video itself?
That's a feature of YouTube in annotations. You just click, once you upload a video, you can annotate it. And it's built into YouTube. Yeah, I'm running short on time, so I'm going to kind of zip through some of the rest of this. This is my son, when he was in grade 7, was studying this book, Underground to Canada, about the Underground Railroad. Anyways, the assignment that he had to make was create a map of the travels that these two young slave girls had to make as they travel through the Underground Railroad to different locations, things happen to them, and they finally make it to Canada and escape. Okay? So, and then, but my son, grade 7, like art's not his thing, and half of the marks are for creativity, which is about creating a map in interesting ways and using materials and all this stuff. And he also like accurately labeling the locations that they were on during their trip. The front of the book has that picture in it. It's a map showing all the locations that they were in, and all the places and the route that they took. So I'm like, what's going on, right? So I said, and art's not his thing. My son's behind the eight ball. So I said, Cass asked if you can do this in another way, using a Google map. So they said, yeah, the teacher gives permission. So what does he do? So he ends up making a Google map. But at first, I had him in a Word document summarize what you learned, right? Like what happened at each location, what happened on the journey between locations. And he complains. A day later, he comes back. I'm done. Okay, Dad, let's make the map. No. Go over to Flickr. I want you to find pictures of what those places actually look like. Find images, Creative Commons. I taught him that and how to cite it properly. And then he goes off for a day looking at pictures. He finds a slave auction block. He finds huts of the you know, like so much history, right? And then he says, okay, I got the pictures, Dad. Now, the map? No. Go to YouTube. I want you to find all these videos around what you were learning, right? Related to the Underground Railroad. He spends a week watching video in YouTube. And when he's done, he creates this map. I don't have time to show you all the stuff that he did, but if you click on any of those places in the map, like that's where they started the Henson Plantation, so there's his summary, the picture he found, cited, with link to video, etc. And he's like, I can keep going. I talked about long-term project work. I talked about it yesterday's session. And it's too bad because it's so awesome. But we're kind of going to go through all that. I'm really sorry. I thought we would have a little more time. And anyways, the last thing I want to say is, like, it's your turn. Right? I'm giving you the background. And I'm showing you some concrete examples. Right? Those three fundamental ways that people learn. Those three instructional practices, right? So now it's up to you. And before you leave, just this to make it. Galleries of thought, your thought and theirs. Good things happen when you publish their work. And do you remember 1620?
Remember a test.
You'll know what they know when they create content that educates and create those stages for them. More resources at k12onlineconference.org for free forever. 4 years worth of content there. Anyways, thanks. Thank you. Oh, if you want to know what happened to your pictures, I'll show them for those that as you're walking out. Thank you.